All right, so as Marinol said, I work at the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials, and I'm a senior director for Family and Community Health, which means I do a lot of stuff. I work in chronic disease a little bit, kind of moving out of that right now, but maternal and child health, health access, evidence-based public health, health equity, hopefully to the extent possible, that in as many areas as possible. So because of that...
That's just the way it is. That's the way yours loaded in.
Well, that's okay. It looks fine to me. Can y'all see that okay?
Mm-hmm.
Is it presentable? I have absolutely no disclosures. Okay? I'm waiting for the day when I can actually put something up there for health equity. That health equity, what a racket, huh? It's my pleasure to be here, and what I'll be speaking to is not just some survey data, but hopefully can be kind of a wrap-up of what's been spoken to so far today. There is going to be some survey data here. There's going to be a little example of a socio-ecological model and some of the state work that's happened. And there's also going to be some inclusion of some qualitative stories that kind of talk about some next steps that we're hoping to look for as we do our work in health equity supporting the state. So let me say a little bit about that. ASLO is the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials. We have exactly 59 members. Are we still at 59? Still at 59 members. That's the 50 states, some territories, including the District of Columbia. With 59 members comes, though, support for the state health agencies, which climb up toward 120,000 public health workers. Now, we did have a profile survey a little earlier in this conference. That number may be dwindling, but it's still a pretty impressive amount of people. The vision, healthy people, thriving in a nation free of preventable illness and injury, and, of course, the mission to transform public health within states and territories to help members dramatically improve health and wellness. So, but what does that mean? Who are the states, and what are they doing? The state health infrastructure, according to recent ASLO survey data, are generally freestanding independent agencies, 55%. The other 45% are located within an umbrella agency within state government. In 13 states and the District of Columbia, and that's 28%. I want you to know a lot of the data up here is going to be the listing of the actual state numbers, and I'll read the percents off to you. What's going to be really tricky is that I wrote them last night by hand, and I think I'll get all of them right. My son, who is doing his math tables right now, called me on the use of my calculator as I was getting the percentages out. I know. In 19 states, that's 37%, local health services are provided by the independent local health departments, and these are kind of in decentralized states. But in 13 states in the District of Columbia, that's 28%, local health services are provided by the state health department. Local is state. The remaining states, 35% function with some combination, kind of a hybrid of decentralized and a mix of services. So this is the map. I like to point out, as our CEO does, Paul Jarrus, our membership goes across 10 time zones. So we're looking not just at North America, but also in the Pacific, all the way over, kind of north above Australia right there. Oh, you can count them if you want. It's like one, two, yeah, I did it once. I counted up to 10, and they're all there. All right, so our current work in health equity is manifold. We do quite a few projects. First, I want to give a shout-out to our senior analyst in health equity, Meenu Mishra, who's right back here. Raise your hand, Meenu. Thank you. Because a lot of this work doesn't happen without her. So first, we have these health equity forums. We had a pretty good forum last year in Denver. And it was a series of, it's a talk with our CEO, with the APHA president, Howard Koh, our president, Commissioner John Auerbach in Massachusetts. And then last year, we had Mirtha Beadle. This was continued this year. A fantastic person from a section at APHA, Elena Ong, pulled together another forum. Panelists include, hi Elena, raise your hand, pull together a forum with Paul Jarrus, Garth Graham, Shiriki Kumanyika, and Jonathan Fielding director of LA County of Health, LA County Department of Health. Okay, we support the OMH's National Partnership for Action, the National Plan for Action. We also work, as I mentioned earlier, to really bring health equity across these different content areas. And it's not just where I'm working in family and community health related content areas, but in across the entire organization. So environmental health, including infectious disease, whatever state health departments are working in, we're trying to fold health equity, support for health equity into those efforts. We have a health equity strategic map, which we'll get to in a second to talk about how our work is guided. And part of how we're moving our work along is with information, and this is what I'm here to present today. The Minority Health Survey taken in 2007 and in 2010. These are environmental scans of state and territorial approaches to minority health, health disparities, and health equity. And we'll get to why it's called the Minority Health Survey in a second. So, ASLO is funded in all of its work by the Office of Minority Health. This is a federal agency within Health and Human Services, although, in case someone here does not know that, health reform has mandated that major federal agencies have an Office of Health Equity, and that's including SAMHSA, the CDC, HRSA, and I'm sure I'm going to miss some others, but now we have to do it. So, that said, this is our strategic map. It's a big jumble of boxes, and it's a lot of words. I wouldn't dream of making you read such tiny script right now. So let's look at some key components. To say that it's a map that kind of helps guide our work for the next 3 years and how we're supporting state health officials and their agencies. The central challenge, which is the big red oval at the top, is to mobilize leadership to achieve public health. This map was pulled together in about a day and a half session with about 25 stakeholders, including representatives from federal agencies and from some of our, say, sister agencies, NACHO, some other nonprofits in the West, Prevention Institute, some key partners. And in a processing exercise, it was important, it was recognized as important by everyone. ASLO's main effort would be to mobilize leadership to achieve public health. These are the priorities under the central challenge. A little bit larger writing for you to read, a little more manageable. Foster societal understanding and will, leverage and engage broad public-private partnerships. And then we have the cross-cutting priorities. I wanted to say that a key part of our efforts from the last year, I didn't put it up there and I should have, was supporting the presidential challenge. Our president from this past year, John Auerbach, made health equity his presidential challenge, and that included a number of different tasks, including coordinating our affiliates and coordinating other organizations and their efforts to support health equity, representing ASLO and representing state health leadership at different presentations, including that presentation that Elena Ong pulled together this year. But most importantly, making sure health equity is a part of the dialogue. And I think the best example of that came from our annual meeting in Portland, Oregon, when our member, Anna Whiting Sorrell from Montana, and our member, Joshua Sharfstein from Maryland, carried on a fantastic discussion on including the topic of racism in discussion, that you cannot move forward in health equity unless you bring up racism. And this gets to some of the root causes and the real historical decisions that have gone into bringing us why we are where we are. So, into the data. Again, this is funded by the Office of Minority Health. It was a survey of state offices of minority health, which is why we call it the Minority Health Survey. Most offices retain that title because it's a key to their history, but also it's a key, it's easily recognized as the source of a certain area of work, and it's easier for them to apply and to get funding. A great deal of need for this research. This is our second Minority Health Survey. We are doing a comparison here, and these are the preliminary steps. There's much work to be done. So the Minority Health Survey in 2007 went out to 57 states and territories, and in the summer of 2010 went out to 59. Our membership does shift occasionally, given some of the circumstances in the Pacific. In 2007, the instrument to evaluate was Insight, Custom Insight, 2010, it was Qualtrics Software. Our response rate in 2007 was 81%. That's 46 out of 57. And in 2010, our response rate was 86%. Very happy about that, because it included all of the states of the Union, as well as the District of Columbia. Survey questions in 2010 included 56 questions. It was created to align with the 2007 survey. It had fewer questions, but we wanted to make sure that the data aligned so that we could do this comparison, addressing state demographics, organizational strategic frameworks, partnerships, planning, training, program focus areas, etc. So let's jump right in. Just another quick piece of information around what exactly Offices of Minority Health are covering, the populations that they're serving. And the one thing I want to point out here is the little burgundy bar, which is kind of in the middle there. For us, working in state public health, it's the rural parts. A lot of the rural populations don't have a voice for them to speak to their needs and to speak to their priorities. And in many instances, the state's department can do that. I also want to point out the fantastic amount of African-American priorities, Hispanic, Asian Americans, and then note that it varies among the states. California has a much higher percentage of Asians, regions 4, region 4 in the southeast, from Louisiana up to North Carolina has a much greater percentage of African Americans, so there's a great variety here. All right, so as mentioned before, we're working with state numbers here specifically. We asked the states how they speak about health equity. We mentioned the topic of the Offices of Minority Health, the Office of Minority Health and HHS, and what this language means, and what different what are different things happening within what we, how we're calling and how we're framing this issue. What's very important to note here, R&E is racial and ethnic. Racial and ethnic health disparities saw the biggest drop, but it's not a loss. They're just kind of moving toward the language of health disparities, and kind of speaking to that gap in health access and health outcomes between populations, which is very important. Next, we asked the question of whether their state had established different priorities for minority health populations. Some examples of state priorities are language access, decreasing disease disparity, reducing infant mortality, and we'll see an example of that at the end of the presentation. And the percentages here, 59% in 2007 said they did, moving to 86% in 2010. Next, we asked, there's a few more questions, but for this presentation, we asked if their agency had a contact person for minority health and health disparity. We'll see a pretty good percentage here, a slight jump from 96 to 98%. So it's a good example of the priority of health equity and health disparities within states. But let's take a look forward to see what this looks like moving forward compared to 2007. I think the biggest jump when we look at that person and their dedication to health equity, we are also brought to the question of what percentage of their time goes to health equity. So we see a pretty stark jump here. A 15% difference in 2007. Their person worked primarily in health equity. It was 61%. That moved to 80% in 2010. Next, we asked if the state interterritorial agency had a minority health or health disparity organizational unit. Again, an impressive jump from 2007 to 2010. A move from 78% said yes, and in 2010 it was 90%. 46 states said yes. We can see, based on information from this survey, but also to note that in the survey we did have some retrospective questions that asked the state health departments to look back at the history of health equity within within the state health infrastructure. We'll see from 1988 to 2010 a steady increase in the number of minority health and health disparity departments, and currently we're at 46 for the previous data. Does your state and territorial agency have a task force or advisory group? We'll see some very little change here, even though there's a greater number with external advisory groups in 2010, percentage-wise, it kind of evens out. and then a legislation or mandate for minority health. It's an impressive little flip here. In 2007, 59% say they did have a mandate, and that switched to 59% said they did not have a mandate in 2010. But let's look at the data and see what this means. It's important to say that there was an increase in the state offices of minority health without a legislative mandate. Does your minority health or health disparity unit get Office of Minority Health funding? It was important to ask this question. Again, the Office of Minority Health and Health and Human Services is a vital part of health equity efforts in this country. So we asked, and of course, we had nine states from whom the data was missing in 2007, but 65% had OMH funding, and that jumped to 78% in 2010. The next question we're looking at, does the state or territory have annual budget for minority health and health disparity activities? A good jump from 67% in 2007 to 84% in 2010. And we want to take a look at some of the funding activity. And again, a retrospective question in 2010 allowed us to take a look at some increase in funding from the state level with that decrease in funding, with a minor decrease in federal funding. Others may include some corporate sponsorships, some very innovative partnering by the Offices of Minority Health. I think what's important to note here is there is a trajectory with federal funding. We know what's happening. And it's something which it's important to pay attention to, but also to see how states may compensate. And we can see here that there's a real priority for health equity at the state level. Looking at federal funding overall, we can see a very slight decrease by agency. The CDC seemed to level out from 2009-2010, one loss, but we see a gradual decrease from most. HRSA has seen an increase. And part of that, you could certainly relate to health reform and the infrastructure investments made by health reform to support access to care. And then the very important question of who makes the decisions about the money. So I think what we can see, the state and territorial health official is kind of leveled off from 2010 to 2007. The jumps are that from 2007-2010, the legislature and the governor has dropped the number of states for whom the legislature and the governor make the budget allocation decisions has dropped. I'm not willing to say right here in this public forum if that's good or bad. And then the last part, well, it's the second to the last part, the partnerships for state and territorial health agencies. It's very important to note tremendous jumps in the health department and other states, the percentage of states that have increased in those partnerships, and that gets to more regional activity, but also state and territorial supported advisory bodies. And then last, local health departments and the increase in partnerships there. The last piece of data we have is, does your state and territorial health agency have a strategic plan for minority health and health disparity? And again, this might be a reflection of some of the shifting of funding that as the Offices of Minority Health have maintained and strengthened their identity within the state public health infrastructure, there is a lack of a strategic plan for 2010. What does this mean? Are they using older strategic plans? Is it a reallocation of resources? I think what's important to say is that when we talk about the infrastructure and the role of the state and territorial health official, that there's a real role from leadership and that the trajectory of effort will continue, is that it may be less systematized, it may speak to some year-to-year funding and the need to argue for more consistent, sustainable funding. I know they're getting ready to take this whole thing down. I know we're one of the last sessions. If that wall comes down, y'all just push back. So conclusions. Despite increasing budget constraints, more states have made health equity and addressing health disparities a priority by really focusing on that reliable and consistent leadership and focusing on increasing partnerships. There are a larger number of offices of minority health, and there's more interagency and integrated planning, working with other parts of state government. Some considerations, we do want to pay attention to the qualitative parts of this to align with another part of this session. We do want to figure out what stories we can lift from states. We have 10 case studies from 2007, which did complement our 2007 Minority Health Survey. We want to do the same thing for 2010. And the second thing to note is that there are some retrospective questions within the 2010 survey, but that these are two set points in time, 2007-2010. I do want to bring up real quick a couple of case studies and something that's going to be inspiring for us. The presidential challenge for this year from Commissioner David Leahy, our member in Texas, our new president, builds heavily on the health equity presidential challenge from last year. He'll be paying attention to infant mortality and healthy babies. And part of this will, of course, entail lifting some best practices. Our member in Maryland, Josh Sharfstein, was fantastic at bringing some best practices into Maryland State Public Health to witness a 13% decline in African-American infant mortality over the course of 2 years from 2007 to 2010. A 13% decline is nothing short of phenomenal, and the trajectory continues. It's done by targeted intervention to subpopulations, culturally competent care and messaging. I got 27 seconds to move through Wisconsin and Dane County. Between 1990 and 2001, the county recovered 73 black infant deaths, African American 17 between 2007 and 2002, a 67% decline from 1990. Why is this? Well, here's my contribution to the discussion on the socio-ecological model. There was three different components: policy, environment, and behavior. That policy component, Medicaid at the state level, was vital, providing resources in the environment, converting a bowling alley, and the behavior of successful health, home visiting programs, breastfeeding seminars, et cetera. These work together, and this is what caused this fantastic drop. Happy to answer any questions. Thank you so much for your time.
Great session. Let's give them another round of applause, everyone. Let's stand up. Stand up, everybody. Stretch. You should be all energized. Okay. Any questions for anyone? Yes.
In working with local health departments on the idea of moving services more upstream to address health disparities, we've run into this exact same issue that you brought up in your study of cutting direct services can end up hurting the people who are experiencing the disparities in the first place. So it just feels like this huge catch-22 to try to address disparities in a way that ends up increasing disparities. And I'm wondering, I mean, you brought it up in certain areas, but I imagine this is something that as you're trying to change from direct service to more upstream services, people are going to say it's happening among those, you know, even in northern Washington State, those people who are experiencing the biggest disparities are going to be hurt by cuts in services. So I don't really know where to go with that when you're working with health departments. It feels like a pretty big irony.
Yeah, I want to be careful about suggesting that, you know, we should stop the bus on this transition to more population-based services or what have you, but more about we should drive this bus very cautiously. I'd like to think as we sort of focus on more population-level services, we are better able to do engagement, surveillance, identifying populations that are falling through the cracks, et cetera, work with our community partners who might be better at providing some of these services. We can't always, traditionally, we in health departments have said we do it better than everybody else, but maybe we don't, maybe that's not necessarily true. So identifying who does some of these services best. And it's hard to do that when you're doing the day-to-day hard work of the direct services. On the other hand, I do think what works well in one setting isn't always what works well in other settings, so trying to figure that out. And another, in my work I'm doing right now, on a larger scale, is this public health FAST study, Public Health Activities and Services Tracking, which is, I was talking about that this morning actually, where we're starting to get more finer-tuned data that represents local health departments in different states, and really looking at getting at a more nuanced view of when those services change over time, what are the health outcomes, and what about those that may reduce some of those direct services, but don't have bad outcomes for those more vulnerable populations. What are they doing different? What's going on there? And my guess is they're engaging more with their partners and that kind of thing. So I'm not sure I'm answering your question, except that it is really complex. I think we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater in either case, but move relatively cautiously on these grounds, because this research for me really sort of screams of, we got to be careful here as we make these changes and do the research, do the due diligence to look at what's happening to our populations and as we, you know, progress, supposedly.
Okay. Any other questions? Oh, yeah.
Hi, my name is Lynn Ong, and I had the pleasure of putting together these two health equity sessions. And I think what's exciting about that is that last year, when we all came here, it health disparities was part of the Healthy People 2010 trajectory, and it's now health equity. So we've got 10 years of health equity implemented. So for the woman who wants to create a future out of it, it's that 10-year lead challenge. And then I don't know what we're going to discover as going to be the new model of equality, but I think health equity really kind of really gets there. And then it's also part of the National Prevention Strategy per the ACA, and it's also part of the National Partnerships for Action. And so we've got these three elements kind of overlaying together. And my question actually is to Albert. I am fascinated with how you chose 2007 and 2010. I am now moving, I'm a person of color, so clearly race is a very important phenomenon to me. But in working with everybody in the caucuses, disability, LGBT, women, I actually did a session on women this year as well. But those are also groups that want to be validated in terms of health equity. And so I want to know about this next frontier. When is the next study that will be taking place? In other words, will it be just before this election year, or will it be just before the next election year, 2016? How did you choose these benchmarks of time, and kind of what are your thoughts about what we should measure?
I think the important thing to know whenever we're surveying our members, again, these are the health commissioners within the states and territories, is that we want to be careful with how often we survey them. Mm-hmm. This is not the only survey that we conduct. In fact, we have a specific division around the evaluation of state public health efforts, the surveys them about, I guess, 6, 7, 8 times per year. So we try to space these surveys out where we're not overtaxing these departments. We're very aware of just how fast they're pedaling already. So we try to space them out enough, but we also want to get them close enough where we get that good sense of that trajectory. And if we can throw some retrospective questions in there to kind of gauge what's happened the last couple of years as we've done with the funding with this questionnaire, then we'll do that. So for us, it's a delicate balance between getting that information to make the argument by not overtaxing the state and territorial health agencies because there are already a lot of them are already very overworked and working. Some of them working on furlough.
Okay. Yes.
I live here in D.C. And our policy, as far as healthcare coverage, you know, covers almost everyone. I think we maybe have 6%. Of the population that's not covered. So, you know, there's the coverage, there are the facilities, whole network of community health centers, you know, hospitals, teaching hospitals, but there's a subpopulation that is consistently non-compliant. And it goes, you know, generation to generation down to school kids. And, you know, our indicators are in the toilet. And so I'm interested in the successful strategies that have dealt with the non-compliant subpopulations that's brought about behavior change. And, you know, in D.C. we're like, you know, the United Nations. We have people from all over. So certainly, you know, being culturally sensitive is really important. And we work with community partners as well as, you know, the local health department doing the work. But we just can't seem to crack, you know, that subpopulation that is non-compliant. And so the services are there, but they don't take advantage. And even when you take, let's say, a bus out, mom's baby bus, you know, that may work some places, but it just, we still are having some difficulty. And it's not just with moms and babies, but, you know, you go the whole span. So what's been successful with the consistently non-compliant population to get them to change their behavior? To see a doctor, to do some of the healthy things?
Which of us are you asking?
Anyone who can talk about, you know, dealing with that population and what's worked.
From my experience in New Orleans, after Katrina, there was a big influx of Hispanics. And this is a worker population. They were going there for the work because work was available. And working in a translational research center, it was important just to get them at points of access. Bang, get one meeting in, and if you give them something free, then there's a chance that they're going to come back. And for mothers and children, there was a chance, diapers, things that were helpful, teethers, pacifiers, these kinds of things. You got to hit them when they come. Talk about undocumented individuals. There's rarely an interface with healthcare, but when you get it, you gotta take full advantage of that and try to incentivize them to return, but don't count on it.
And then I'll just go back to sort of work I've done previous. I did HIV/AIDS work for many years, and I think part of it also is not assuming that we understand why people aren't coming in. We did work with getting oral care, and we went in with an assumption that said that dentists didn't want to provide care to people with HIV because they really didn't. They were afraid of universal precautions, they were afraid of transmission, and this was years after all the work was done. And we actually decided that we talked with people and asked them instead of our assumption of what was going on, and what we learned was that people just don't like going to the dentist. It didn't matter if you're HIV positive or not. And so it didn't become, we need more dentists to do this. It became, how do we incentivize? And we often relate to not really wanting to go to the dentist. So I think part of it is taking advantage of every opportunity and then being able to put our biases or our assumptions aside and asking people what is the barrier, what is, you know, what's going on.
And I really believe in this concept that there's really something to this concept of targeted services, that we can really provide these blanket services, and these large-scale messages are for sure going to reach somebody like me, who can read and understand and pay money to go to the gym and all these other things. But as we get to these harder populations that may be harder to reach or aren't less well reached by these same messages that easily get to me, we really do need to better understand how to target services to some of these harder to reach populations. So, really balancing that business of doing large scale health improvement, but really understanding when and under what conditions we really have to target some services for certain population groups, when that's really the only way to reach certain populations, is I think what we have to do.
I want to build on that and say that there's something that's happened in Arkansas as a study that I've run into, where they discovered it was a lot easier to provide services than to vet the candidates and to go through the paperwork to see if they were actually or could be documented. So I think that there are some mechanisms that can work from a more policy-centric level. It's worth advocating for.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? There's one in the back.
It's not a question. I have a resource if anyone is interested in looking at Astro's Health Equity Strategic Map. I have a copy. So look at it up close. You can take home a copy. So come to me.
Oh, okay, great. Other questions, comments? Did I see a hand in the back? Oh, no. It's like bidding, you can't move.
Dr. McQuire, I'm also from Washington State, and I'm with Liz, and we've been doing health equity training in Watkins County. And I just wanted to clarify what you said about targeting. One of the things that we're thinking about there is when we recognize that we're reducing services by changing to health equity training. So do you think that targeting specific areas that have health disparities is a good approach that leaders are taking?
And by areas, you mean
specific populations that are disproportionately have disparities?
I think so. I've been really interested in Washington State as an example. We cut our maternal child health services to the bone, right? And a few health departments are taking these really kind of pretty interesting approaches at very, very systematically identifying, taking their maternal child health money from the state and saying, we are done trying to provide a thinner and thinner layer of service to the whole population. Let us use it and really identify a community, a really hard-hit community with very dramatic low-birth weight disparities, and use a social terms of health approach and really do an entirely different approach. And that is one way of targeting, a specific problem in a community, and it's very, I want to say it's super creative and innovative and exciting, but it's also kind of the old way we used to do things 100 years ago. It's fun to see that model, getting some attention. It'll be interesting. We want to see what happens too. We should be looking to see what specifically happens in that community, and can they make change? So to me, that's one way of targeting. Another way of targeting is are there specific population groups that really are not. Whose needs really aren't met in some of our more traditional means, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I do think we have to do some really creative thinking about that. That gets to your question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I just want to make an announcement. Yesterday, Paul Jarrett did a fabulous job actually talking about the difference between goodness and fairness.
And that really kind of, I mean, when you kind of talk about a highest level of attainable health for all, but, you know, that just obfuscates the data for, like, Pacific Islanders, et cetera. And so the fairness question is indeed the essence of the questions of how do we actually get to the most hard-hit populations and improve their health, just in the case examples that you gave. I wanted to say that I'm the co-chair of the working group on social determinants of health for the community health planning and development section, and I invite you all to check out our website because we'll be continuing from this process that we all learn and benefit from. So I want to just thank you all for doing this. It's great.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for developing it. And let me just add to your question, if I may, just for a second. I actually think I'm from one of the hardest hit areas in the country, Mississippi. I've been down there developing public health programs. I went down from Harvard, and it is amazing. I've learned quite a lot from working with community, directly with the community. And one of the things that I find is helpful is to invite communities, or at least members from these areas, to be a part of whatever planning that you're doing. Instead of like going into the community saying, okay, you need X, Y, and Z. Okay, they might not. We might think that they need it. We might think that's why they're not following up, but let them tell us why. And actually, that has been very productive. For example, simple things, you know, like, for example, obesity, that's one of my issues that I've been tackling for years, is a lot of people think that eating is a big problem. You know, we know eating and physical activity are both associated, but in an area where there is not a built environment, and when you think about the one thing that a person can do to try to prevent obesity and our risk factors, it's eating and our behavioral modifications. We might be somewhere where we can't participate in physical activity, but yet still we usually eat. And just simple little health promotion, education, activities like reading the labels on boxes, I have found is absolutely extraordinary. One person, for example, asked me when I was in the grocery store if a particular container had salt in it, S-A-L-T. She said, you know, I've got high blood pressure, so I don't want to eat a lot of salt, and this brand is something that I have been eating for years. Well, that brand had a high content of sodium, and she wasn't aware that sodium and salt, okay, are comparable. So it's just the little things that we could do that people could tell us that might be one of the reasons, etc. And in reference to health and healthcare, transportation, some people are out in communities and they actually can't get to the doctor. It's not because they just don't utilize the services. They don't have the mode of transportation to get to the services. So oftentimes when we're reading the data that a particular group is not being, well, I won't say that they're not following up, but they're not utilizing the services, of course, we want to ask the question, why? And by going to the underserved community, the community that is, you know, the one that we're focusing on, oftentimes, you know, if you let them tell us, you'd be surprised with some of the answers. Are there other questions? Okay, well, if not, let's again thank our wonderful panel. Let's thank Dr. An for putting together this session. Thank you, said An. Okay. And we'll see you next year for the 140th in San Francisco.